Our governor has declared us officially open for business, is inviting travelers in from everywhere to come get a shot and take a socially distanced Alaskan vacation. And locally, it appears we've not seen the post-spring break spike many feared was going to happen. But we are seeing small numbers of positive cases virtually every day. How are we doing? What's new? What do you need to know? The good doctors are here again to answer your questions. If you have one, email lowdown@kmxt.org or call 486-3181, and we will try and get it in before the end of the show. Again, Dr. Shanna Theobald from the Kodiak Ambulatory Care Clinic and Dr. Evan Jones from CANA are our guests this morning. Thanks. Nice to see your faces today.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, well, let's just start with, you know, it's been a couple of weeks. Things seem to be sort of percolating along relatively safely. Things are starting to get back. That's the feeling that a lot of people have. Seems like a lot of people are at the airport all the time and in the stores. How are we doing? How are you doing at your clinics?
I think locally we're doing fairly well. My friends and I have been talking about what's happening in Michigan and other places, that it's concerning, but in Kodiak we seem to be doing fairly well. We've talked about this lots of times. The British variant has really hit Michigan hard. The B117 variant has hit Michigan hard. And unfortunately, that means it hits kids hard. And so there's been a lot of kids brought into the hospital there. And I know it's all over the place now, but we seem to be doing pretty well locally.
Just for those who aren't familiar with the shortcuts, you know, the B117 is traditionally called the what?
British variant.
Right. So we have the B111, and we have the B1351, and then we have a P21. Those are seem to be the predominant ones that are running around now, right?
Yeah, the B117 is the UK variant, and that one's the one that's more contagious and increased illness associated with it. The P1 we're still gathering information on. And then there's the B, I think it's the 1671 from India that has, you know, the two mutations that appear to be highly concerning. And yeah, might be part of what's driving the just massive surges of hospitalizations and death in India right now. And also just a really quick one to put a plug in. Kodiak is doing well, but we are actually falling far behind some of our Alaskan rural communities. Petersburg has around 75% of their population vaccinated. Skagway, Bethel, Nome, a lot of the kind of outer lying areas in Alaska have around the 70 to 75%. We're right around 50% right now. So we got a lot of work to do. We got Crabfest coming up too, and I encourage everyone get vaccinated, you know, convince two other people to get vaccinated before Crabfest so that we aren't running into, you know, a lot of these variants coming in and potentially causing more burden in our community with our kids. The biggest thing we're seeing now is an increase in hospitalizations in kids. We're at the peak rate in the nation right now for pediatric hospitalizations due to COVID, probably related to the B117. So I'm going to put that plug in and, jump on that update for the community.
So we,
that's definitely why I mentioned the British variant, is because we still can't vaccinate these kids. And so it's time for the adults to step up and protect the kids in this community, because not many kids were being hospitalized with the wild type strain of this. Lots more kids are getting it and getting hospitalized from this British variant. And the vaccine does seem to be effective against this British variant. We can't vaccinate those kids. We can vaccinate the adults. So now's the time for the adults to be the grown-ups and get vaccinations so that we can protect the kids in this community. And so I feel like from a disease point of view, we're doing pretty well in this community. From a vaccine point of view, we were number one in the nation for percentage of vaccination. We're now number 21, even though we have lots of vaccinations available. We are the 21st in the country with percentage of vaccinations done now. So we have slipped a long ways. And it does mean that everybody who's listening to this, if you're not vaccinated, let me tell you, I see people every day with the long COVID or post-COVID or whatever you want to call it. I have never once seen a patient for a post-injection concern. I've seen a lot of patients for pre-injection concerns before they get the vaccine, but I've not even seen one patient for a post-injection concern.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that, a lot of people are kind of waiting to see how the vaccine is going to play out. And keep saying, don't wait, you know, don't wait, you could get COVID. And actually, like really close to home, my mom got sick and she's been really fatigued, having difficulty breathing for a few weeks. And she was one of the kind of waiting to see how the vaccine would play out. It also wasn't very available in Minnesota, but we just keep hearing these stories over and over again. And if you compare the side effects of the vaccine to the side effects of COVID, side by side, all comers, you know, people say, oh, you have a 99% survival rate. That doesn't count the long haulers symptoms that people are getting from COVID. But also, if the vaccine only had a 99% survival rate, nobody would be getting it. So just really, you know, kind of trying to put it in perspective and really looking at all the data and all the science, not just the conspiracy theories or just the, you know, the random things that pop up. Compare the VAERS report to the actual side effects from COVID, and it's no-brainer about which one you're going to want to get.
And on top of that, once again, the one of the big concerns I've been hearing from some people is that somebody is putting out there that the spike protein, there's a similar protein that occurs during pregnancy that can make women infertile and stuff like that. First of all, it's not true. I mean, there's lots of similar proteins between everything in the world, where the proteins are universal throughout living creatures. But the big thing is, if you get COVID, guess what you're going to have an immune response to? Well, probably one of the things is going to be the spike protein. But there's going to be 100 other proteins that your body looks at on the virus too. And so you're only getting a small portion of the antibodies when you get the vaccine as compared to if you actually get COVID. Because your body doesn't just focus on the spike protein. It focuses on any parts of that virus that it can detect. And you might have end up with more than one type of antibody at different times. And this is where a lot of autoimmune diseases occur, is that a virus comes in and it has some similar parts of to your body and can create an autoimmune disease. But we haven't seen that with this vaccine. This is a much safer way of introducing immunity to this disease.
So
that's similar. Real quick about the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccine causing the blood clots. There is a similar, it's basically an activated protein towards one of the clotting factors. But again, the virus itself is basically giving your body that same type of protein and creating an immune response to it. So people who have had COVID are at much higher risk of blood clots than people who get either the Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca vaccine. So yeah, kind of piggybacking on what Dr. Jones just said, no matter how you slice it and compare the vaccines to COVID, you're at much greater risk for getting the virus itself.
That is one of the constant things we consistently hear. I mean, we did really well when we first opened up the vaccine to the medical providers and to the over 65 group and then the compromised group. Our percentages were really high. And then it opened to the rest of the population, which dropped us down to 50% of the population only being vaccinated and having enough vaccine available. Now we're like giving it away to people who come here. The constant argument that people make is this 99% argument that, you know, it's not that serious of a disease. You know, even if I get it, it's not going to do anything to me. And so why should I do it? You rush this vaccine into production. I don't want to be a guinea pig, and nobody's going to tell me I have to take it. You know?
I agree. You shouldn't have to be a guinea pig. But it's been pretty well tested at this point, pretty well researched at this point. Is it as vigorous and long a study as the other ones? It really is not. But I keep going back this type of vaccine has been tested for many, many years, just not for this purpose. But here's where I stand. I'm all about protecting the kids of this town. And if it does make me a little bit of a guinea pig, I'm all about it. I'm all about putting myself in harm's way rather than putting kids in harm's way. And I don't think we have to enter this with fear, because a lot of us have gotten this vaccine and we've had extremely low side effects at all. And this kind of 99%, it's really higher than that. It's higher than 99% survival rate with COVID. It's a luxury of the Western hemisphere that we're rich enough that even if we don't believe in COVID, we know that the hospitals are going to care for us and help us out if we do get sick. It's a luxury we have. I guarantee people in India would be clamoring to get this vaccine if it were available to them, but it's simply not available to them. But I encourage people to think beyond themselves and think about ending this disease by getting as many people vaccinated as possible so that we can stop these variants. We can stop the spread of it to around the world and to our kids. I don't like using kind of guilt and fear sort of tactics, but it is the truth of the matter, is that this town are the ones that can be vaccinated. The kids can't be. And as far as not being affected by it, we were just discussing before we came on the air, there's a actual cognitive testing done with 100 people after they had been hospitalized for COVID, and 80 of them had declined cognitive ability after having COVID and this kind of brain fog that's often described. So it was 81% in the end have a cognitive disability, and it's probably temporary. I'm hoping it's temporary at least, but after being hospitalized for COVID. It's not as deadly a disease as we originally thought it was, but frankly, it's got more comorbidities than we ever thought it would early on. It does pretty terrible things to the body that are long lasting beyond the month, beyond 6 months. Like I said, I treat patients on a frequent basis for the long hauler, the long COVID, whatever you want to call it. But the top part is I have very little to offer them. I don't know what to tell them. I give them, I hope they'll get better, but I don't know the truth on that.
Yeah. And one more thing too, a lot of people don't realize the case fatality rate of COVID is still 2 to 9%. In other words, of all the positive tests, including, you know, the asymptomatic ones, the ones who just got tested because they had a contact, compared to deaths, 2% of people who have had a positive test have died in the United States. It's up to 9% in Mexico, which obviously means, you know, probably they just don't have enough testing to test all the people who are asymptomatic with the infection. But compared to the flu, which is, you know, 0.1% mortality on average, depending on the flu strain as well, because some flus are really deadly, like the 1918-1919 pandemic. This is probably as high morbidity mortality as the 1918 flu, or maybe higher. It's hard to really compare because that happened 100 years ago before we had testing, and a lot of people were probably asymptomatic then as well. And we just kind of guesstimate based on the numbers that we have. So I want to also just put out, this is a very deadly disease. Look what's happening in Brazil. Look what's happening in India. It's not a hoax. It's not, you know, a government thing. This is a global pandemic that is affecting a lot of people, and the morbidity is almost worse than the mortality. So, yeah.
You raised an interesting point with the statistics there, in that the people who were tested for long hauler disease had been hospitalized, but this long hauler doesn't necessarily come only with people who get hospitalized, right? I mean, aren't there people with fairly mild symptoms of this that still experience those kind of symptoms?
Yeah, we looked at people who were considered to have mild to moderate symptoms. A very large percent of them had cardiac abnormalities after having COVID. And so severe disease. to damage your heart, and I think it likely probably damages your brain. It's actually a little bit rare for this virus to actually enter where your brain is, to actually physically infect your brain. But because it causes clotting and it causes other issues with the body, it does still affect you don't necessarily end up with a viral meningitis, but you do end up with downstream effects of the hypercoagulability that you seem to get with COVID.
Well, that makes it even more of an argument against the people who say, you know, even if I get this, nothing's going to happen to me. I'm not going to die, because death is only one result. You know, there are other fairly traumatic results that you can get from this, even if you don't die, even if you have a fairly mild case.
Yeah, there's some people who are requiring lung and heart and kidney transplants, and they do not count on the death list. They didn't die, but is their life radically changed? Absolutely. And are those pretty rare? Yeah, those are pretty rare too. We've said it on the show many times. I personally have patients who are in great shape. Being honest, young women seem to be affected by this more than anyone. But I've had young women who were in their 30s in great shape, who now have to take a break when they get up to use the bathroom because they're winded halfway to the bathroom, and we're months later. And I don't know what to tell them, what the long run situation is going to be for them. Is this going to be the rest of their life, or is this just going to be a something that eventually kind of clears up? I don't know.
I'm going to take this question that was hanging out from a while. My parents live in the lower 48. They've had COVID and now believe they can't get it again. They're also traveling across the country, vacationing, and going about their life normally again. What can I do to talk to my folks?
That's a good question. I would start by showing them the data on reinfection rates, and also, some of the case studies show that people that get infected a second time have a much worse illness than, the first time around. And you're not 100%, you're not completely immune necessarily just because you've had it once.
Well, it sort of morphs right into what's happening in India right now. I mean, I think the medical response in India is one of puzzlement. They had assumed, because they had everything in line, they had locked things down, they were doing great. When the infections came in, they thought that a large percentage of the big cities had already been infected. So now with this new surge through the country, I mean, the numbers are astronomical. Like 300,000 people a day are being infected. And it may be because it's this new variant that's going through there, but because you had COVID doesn't really mean that you're not going to get some other version of it when it comes through.
Yeah, like 3,000 people a day in India are dying right now. And it's so interesting. I heard a lot of people say, well, look at India. You know, it's a developing country and they don't have a lot of COVID. Or look at, these other different countries that don't seem to have a burden of the disease like the United States. And from an epidemiology perspective, listening to epidemiologists on this, we don't know exactly why the pattern is playing out globally like it did. It's very interesting because the 1918-19 flu pandemic had very similar, where it would just like light up in countries all of a sudden, probably related to variants, but we didn't have the information from that time. But Dr. Osterholm says this, and I think it's a really good way to look at this whole virus and pandemic. We are not driving this tiger, we are riding it. And there's a lot of things we don't know why the patterns are happening they are, but we, at this point, the main thing is we need to take it seriously, recognize for the high morbidity and mortality that it has, and then do our part in trying to mitigate that morbidity and mortality in our communities. And the ways we do that are kind of what we've been doing, the masking, social physical distancing until we're vaccinated and have kind of more of that herd immunity. But we, at this point, the variants are a kind of unknown how they're going to play out. And it looks like the vaccines have decent protection against the B1.1.6.7.1, the India double mutant variant that people, you know, you've probably seen in the news. But it takes time to fully see how much, you know, immunity the vaccine, protection the vaccine has. And so in the meantime, I think we still just need to be really cautious because it could, you know, a surge could come through at any minute. And I know people are so tired of hearing this. And a lot of times my husband was saying, hearing about COVID now is like hearing about road construction. Like people are just like, it's in one ear, out the other. You just kind of dismiss it because everyone's just not even so tired of it, but you just, it doesn't seem like it's affecting us very much right now. And we're just kind of over it, but there, it still is out there. And we still, there's still this beast that we have to be cautious of and just know it's around.
So Dr. Jones, I'm going to ask you, like, put yourself in a room with this guy's parents, you know, of he comes in and he drags the parents in with him and says, you convince them that they need to get this, you know, they need to change their behavior.
Yeah. So I'm a little looser than a lot of people with this, that I actually want people to enjoy it. I want to go down and enjoy Crab Fest coming up soon. I want to be out there with the crowds outdoors. I'm still not super excited about the indoor crowds. But my big thing is I have a friend who's a doctor who got this, and she ended up getting the vaccine on top of it. And I think that's a smart way to go. She comes on this radio show a lot. the big thing to me is we start have waning. We don't know how long we get immunity with the wildlife infection. I don't know where they'll be at with their getting reinfected. The emphasis of the original, hey, you got the COVID, and it does provide immunity. Now, if they get the shot at this point, in some ways we joked about it before, but really they're going to be super resistant to this disease in the future. And if they are a little more careless, it's okay. And they know they're not going to be spreading around to other people. So if you're all about being careless out there, be careless with the vaccine rather than without the vaccine. That's my big emphasis for this. If you're going to Crab Fest, don't want to wear a mask or do any of that stuff or outdoor stuff, which I do not want to wear a mask outdoors. If you're going to be one of those people, get vaccinated first so you know you're not spreading it to the kids around you or to the people around you. And so for me, I don't want them to pull up things that they read on the internet. I don't want them to look at their Facebook feed and say, look, this person says their head exploded right after getting the vaccine. I want them to talk to their friends who have gotten the vaccine. I want them to look at people they actually know and talk to them who've actually been through it to base their judgment. There's so much false information on the internet right now. And I joked about it once that it was China trying to weaken America. But the truth of the matter is they actually did trace it down to Russia is kind of sending out false information as they've manipulated our social media quite a bit over the years. And so don't listen to the false information out there. Talk to people you know and trust. You really are falling into the hands of some nefarious people who are trying to manipulate you. When there's so many doctors in this country who have read about this and researched it, and I was a little concerned going into it. And once I read and researched it, I realized this is a pretty safe vaccine, and we can make this happen fairly easily.
Thank you. Which leads me into the relaxation of masks outdoors. One, give me your take on that, and two, it only applies to people who've been vaccinated. So, you know, we we don't have a passport that says you cannot, you know, you don't have to wear a mask outside. So somebody who's not vaccinated could not wear a mask outside too. How do we deal with that? I mean, how do you identify the, in other words, if you're a vaccinated person and you want to go out and do something safely, it seems kind of odd to me that you would take the leap of taking the mask off if you don't know what the nature of your community is, because you don't know if the person sitting next to you with no mask on has been vaccinated or not.
Yeah, the CDC does say, you know, if you're in a crowded area outside, you should still wear, everyone should still wear a mask. So if you're around a lot of people, I think definitely. I mean, if you're outside, and it says specifically either with your family, with other vaccinated people, or kind of in an open area, that's when it's safe to remove the mask. It's not just outdoors in general. And yeah, especially if you're going to be around in close proximity with other people, and you don't know, and they're strangers and you don't know if they're vaccinated or not, I would still say, you know, just keep your mask on for, or move farther away, just for, you know, safety at that point. But there are some caveats to it. It's not just a kind of open door policy that, yeah, I think kind of understanding and just thinking of it exactly like what you said, you're around other people, you don't know if they're vaccinated or not. There's no way for you to know, because you're not going to probably, if you don't know them, you're not going to go up and ask them. Then just presume, you know, in that case, I would say presume that they're probably not vaccinated and do what you would do before.
Okay. Well, give me your take on Alaska opening up now for vacationers and providing vaccines to anybody who comes to the state. I mean, you know, it takes a couple of weeks for a vaccine to work, right? So what value does it have if you're saying, come on into our state and here we'll give you a shot at the airport and come back in 3 weeks?
Yeah, it's a tough one because it probably is not very effective in the first, especially the first 2 weeks, it's probably not very effective. And if they're bringing the disease with them, if they're unvaccinated, it does leave our population at risk. There's a part of me, though, that feels like anything to get people vaccinated, if they need to come here to get it done or whatever it takes to get people vaccinated, is a good thing. I understand it's a hard thing to say, oh, let's shut down the tourist system again this year. It's hard on a lot of people here in Alaska, and I think we just need to encourage people to be safe when they're doing it, and a shot definitely isn't going to hurt when they cross into Alaska. It'd certainly be a lot better if they did it before they came to Alaska, though.
I got a couple of questions. One, is it safe to order animal ivermectin online and take it as a COVID prevention?
I can't even answer that one. It's an interesting question. You know, I kind of love these weird treatments. It's definitely an antiviral in some ways, whether it's actually effective or not. We really haven't done a good study. They've done a study in very sick people with ivermectin, and it appears to be ineffective in very sick people. Does it prevent the disease? I have no idea. I wouldn't want to bet my life on it. I'd much rather bet my life on the vaccine at this point, because it has pretty good data behind it, than ivermectin, which maybe, I mean, who knows? It's possible. I've kind of had a record of saying, yeah, it's interesting, we should look at it, but I'm not willing to bet on it.
Yeah, also vet medicines are often in different preparations, a lot of times more concentrated for, you know, bigger weights like horses and cows or whatever. So definitely, I would say definitely don't order ivermectin prepared for animals. And yeah, you're not going to get the right dosing necessarily. And it's not made for humans to take. If we were in a third world country, we had nothing else. I mean, we talked about that before. A lot of countries are doing this because that's just a cheap, effective thing, or a cheap medication that they have that might be effective. But studies that have been done now in the United States have not proven that it is necessarily effective. And there might be more harms than we realize. You know, when you really look at a controlled double-blind study, that's when we really get the data, not just kind of shooting from the hip of whether we think it worked or not. And it's not panning out the way that when they are really studying it, which I agree, I think we should have studied it, is a potentially affordable, easy option that is, you know, made in abundance and it's an old medication. I think that would be the ideal thing, that we have a treatment that's cheap and widely distributed. But at the same time, just like hydroxychloroquine, we have to really look at the data. And unfortunately, ivermectin just not panning out to be as good as we thought maybe it would be based on really preliminary data. And basically these developing countries that use ivermectin all the time. And one of the, a couple of the studies were looking and saying, look, there's not a high burden of COVID in these countries and they are all on ivermectin. So therefore it must be good for COVID. But now we're seeing the virus playing out completely differently in those same countries. And so it probably doesn't have anything to do with ivermectin.
That's it. That's exactly my experience. I have a good friend who's a nurse practitioner in Cambodia. And she was like, we have very low COVID here. It's not an issue for us here in Cambodia. And she was quoting that same thing, that ivermectin is widely used there, and she thought it might be preventative. Unfortunately, she just wrote me recently and says that it has been raging through her country, and it's been a pretty difficult thing for her to live through. We are pretty insulated from this disease in the United States. She says there that they shut everything down. It's hard to even find food there. Everything is shut down. You go through Phnom Penh and there's nobody allowed on the streets. She says that you can usually get rice, but that's it. So some people have been subsisting off of rice for the last 2 weeks, and that's whatever animals they have around them. So it's been a pretty tough time for people there in a place that had a fairly low COVID burden a month and a half ago.
So how are they doing in terms of importing vaccines to give out?
Terrible. You know, we're a rich country, so we're able to get, we have COVID vaccines waiting for people in this town. And people have the luxury of knowing that the hospital is going to bail them out if they get sick. In India, hospitals are telling people, you're on your own. It doesn't matter how sick you are, you're on your own. We don't have room to treat you anymore. We're here in the U.S., because of our wealth, we're able to set up tents and set up additional places outside the hospital in a matter of days to take care of extra patients if it really ripped through here. The people who tend to not believe in this tend to be people are pretty insulated because they're not looking beyond, you know, their own neighborhood to see that this is a disease that is killing off a lot of the world and affecting a lot of the world. And because of our wealth, we are somewhat insulated from it. Because of our wealth, we can afford to say, no, I'm not going to get the vaccine.
Let's go back to this ivermectin question. It's come up a couple of times. When you go to the doctor and you get a prescription for something, and you realize how much it costs on a monthly basis, and then you just happen to go into the vet clinic and Fido gets the exact same medicine, and it's, you know, a third or a quarter of the price. Isn't there a, you know, I think a lot of people think, hey, you know, I'm just going to go get the stuff from the vet and take that because it's way cheaper.
I'm not going to endorse or deny that I've ever done that. But this just came up with a friend of mine ended up with pinworms, and in Cambodia, the medicine, the albendazole or mebendazole, I don't remember which one they had. In Cambodia, it's about 25 cents for a tab. Here in Kodiak, $950. You could almost afford to fly to Cambodia, buy the medicine there, and fly back and have it cheaper than what it costs here in Kodiak. So there's no doubt that there's a huge premium put on some of these medications if they're meant for humans, or in this case, if it's really unusual disease. We don't treat too many parasitic infections here in the United States. We're places where it's treated all the time. It's actually fairly inexpensive also. I don't know what to tell you about using medications meant for animals. For the most part, as long as they're prepared in a safe way, they're probably identical. But I don't think there's quite as vigorous of regulations around. I don't even know. I don't know if there's vigorous regulations around animal meds compared to humans. I'm a little surprised how loosey-goosey the medication market in the U.S. is about how it's handled when I really read into it. But if prepared correctly, there's a lot of medications we use for our dogs that we use in humans that should be exactly the same, from pain meds to anti-parasitic medications to even nutritional supplements.
There are some differences. The FDA reviews both the active and inactive ingredients and dosing for humans, but it does not review, the FDA doesn't oversee the active and inactive ingredients that are meant for animals. So there could be inactive ingredients that are added to animal preparations that haven't been studied and are not necessarily known whether how safe they are for humans. So I would strongly encourage people to not use the veterinarian, but you're right. I mean, when you go to other countries, like exactly anti-malarials, anti-parasitic treatments, a lot of like antifungal treatments are so affordable there. And it does make you wonder why they're so expensive here. Part of it is because we don't mass produce it. And the smaller the batch you make, the more expensive it is to produce it. Part of it is the business of, you know, our pharmaceutical companies, which I think is a really important ethical conversation to have, you know, on a bigger political scale, like, you know, going to Washington, D.C. and talking to our lawmakers about how we should regulate and control some of those industries so that they're not just gouging people. But yeah, I think just in general, trying to make sure we're just recommending the safe medication preparations, or if you have connections to another country. I mean, I have a lot of patients that come from other countries and have similar medications available there that are way cheaper. And I say, you know, have your family members send you something from another country, because it has been studied for humans at least.
But the bottom line, regardless of which way you went, you both of you would not recommend people just sort of taking ivermectin. I mean, is there anything that you can take other than vitamin D? Is there any progress we've made on that forefront of preventing yourself from getting COVID or reducing the symptoms?
Yeah, we do. We have a vaccine that works really well. I find it so interesting that people are willing to take dog medicine overtaking a vaccine. They're like, yeah, this makes sense to me. I'm going to take medicine that my dog or cow normally takes rather than getting this vaccine. it's just an interesting thing that people are so willing to accept these super oddball things as, and with a faint glimmer of hope that maybe they might work. We don't know, but it's possible. Rather than taking something that seems to be doing really well.
So just getting the vaccine by itself, I mean, you wouldn't supplement it with something else. I mean, I guess I'm asking, if the person was vaccinated, would be there any benefit to taking ivermectin?
We haven't seen any yet, but has it been super well studied? I don't know. Maybe Dr. Theobald has more information.
I have another question from two questions. One, is the Coast Guard and Navy base providing vaccinations for their members?
I don't know the answer to that. Do you know, Dr. Theobald?
I'm sorry, what was that question?
Is the Coast Guard providing any vaccinations to Coast Guard personnel? Is the Navy providing vaccinations? I don't know if they're...
Yeah, the Coast Guard definitely is. I know the pharmacy that I am in contact with, they are trying to get the Coast Guard vaccinated. And then as far as the Navy, I don't know, but I imagine definitely, yes, the military is usually gives out a lot of vaccines. But I don't know a contact for that. But
well, I know that because it's an emergency use order that it's not required yet, but the Coast Guard will likely be moving towards a requirement for this vaccination once it comes off the emergency use list.
So now there are certain members of the Coast Guard, depending on the nature of your job, that are required to get a vaccine, but for the majority of them, I think it's still voluntary. But the vaccines have been available for a month or so.
Yeah.
What's your take on this? How about asking local businesses to post signs stating, we've all been vaccinated in here, so we can know which businesses to avoid?
Hey, it's advertisement, whatever you want to do. I think private businesses have the right to hang whatever, almost any sign they want, as long as it's true. If they feel like that's a big selling point to them, saying that all of our employees have been vaccinated, good for them. That's part of the freedom they have as of owning their own business.
As a person giving advice to somebody who's been vaccinated, though, with the current restrictions you have on you, I mean, would you still travel to Michigan, for instance, even though you've been vaccinated? You know, would you travel to a state that didn't have high numbers of vaccinations and didn't practice social distancing and didn't have a mask requirement?
At this point, I would not. I wouldn't do any unnecessary travel, period. I mean, you know, we're still pretty in the high risk in Anchorage area. Canada's also seeing a huge surge in infections right now. Also, just so you know, traveling through Canada is potentially risky. And the lower 48, we're seeing a lot of surging in the states as well. So I think still continue to avoid unnecessary travel, or that would be what I do. I actually was going to try to go to California, and it was kind of right at the beginning of the surge, and I just canceled that trip. But yeah, necessary travel, I think definitely get vaccinated before you travel. Wear the mask, you know, throughout the duration of your flight and while you're in the airport, and or double mask really is still, I think, a good way to keep more potential variants out. And then limit the circles. And if you're traveling to see vaccinated people, then that's also another kind of big consideration. But my main thing is our community here, not wanting to be, you know, someone who brings in a variant and still keeping us safe here until we see better how this plays out.
Well, you know, it does appear that, you know, we think things are returning to normal in the United States, and that we're ahead of the game. We have a lot of vaccines. Businesses are starting to reopen. We see pockets of high infections here and there, but even though the administration has done an amazing job of vaccinating people, we haven't really done much towards knocking down the numbers. I mean, we're up to what, 42% or 28% or something of that of the American population has been double shotted, but our numbers are still 65,000 people a day are still contracting this disease. And it really doesn't seem like we've made a, it seems like the country as a whole is still kind of medium to high risk.
Yeah, that's true. We are vaccinating around 3 million people a day, which is really great in the big picture. But you're right. We're definitely not out of the woods yet. And it will still remain to be seen how these variants play out. And I think just continuing on with this caution, I think we're close to the kind of back downside of the pandemic, where we really can say, you know, it is getting better. And not just kind of this roller coaster ride. But I think we're not quite there yet. And we're seeing a surge. So far, it looks like the curve's being flattened. And I think that probably has a lot to do with the vaccinations that people have gotten. And there's still not great mitigation mitigation efforts in play, but better than nothing at all. I think if we had nothing at all, we would see a huge surge. But continue, you know, if each person continues that, I think that's what's going to save us from a potentially even bigger surge.
I have a follow-up from the person who asked the ivermectin question about that veterinarian ivermectin is directed towards parasites, right? That's what it's being used for. So if you're using that stuff over the counter here, what are you really treating? I mean, what if on the odd chance that we have parasites, is it killing them off? But what else does it do?
It's a little bit different because a lot of these anti-parasitic medications do have mild antiviral properties. And so it's not that we're treating parasites at all. And the reason that these have been studied, whether it's the hydroxychloroquine or the ivermectin, is both of them do have mild antiviral properties, probably not enough to affect this disease. If I were to guess, I would guess that, and could they decrease the severity? Probably. It's possible. I'm not going to say it's impossible that it decreases the severity. It's probably not going to prevent the disease, like a lot of people are hoping. If you just take your vitamin ivermectin every morning, you're not going to get the disease. But almost a lot of the anti-parasitic medications do have antiviral properties. And that's why they have been studied, and that's why they're of interest to a lot of people.
Well, we're going to close this week with a little bit about kids. You know, about there has been an increase in pediatric hospitalizations in the United States. The numbers that are coming in from India and Brazil seem to be showing that this is actually creating among the young population, even beyond the kids, the 30-year-old population there in Brazil in particular, it's been really hard hit with hospitalizations and deaths. And there seems to be an enormous amount of young kids who've been infected in India. That doesn't portend very well for us not being vaccinated here.
That doesn't. There's a huge number of kids are being affected by these variants because they're much more transmissible at this point. It did seem like kids would get it. It was a little more rare. It was a little more mild disease when the kids would get it. But now it seems to be hitting them pretty hard. Michigan has been hospitalizing a lot of kids. You know, the death rate is still lower, far lower among kids than it is among older people, but it is hitting them pretty hard enough to get them into the hospital. I do have one last thing I want to talk about before we end too.
Okay.
So we've all been sitting around not doing enough during this whole COVID-19 time, myself included. I've gotten a little on the fluffy side. So I'm going to encourage listeners, and I'm going to encourage all the people listening out there. I've set a goal for myself this summer. I am going to take 1 million steps this summer, which sounds crazy, but it's, if you break it down, it's not too much. It's a lot, but for June, July, and August, if we get out there, get outdoors, it's important to get outside and take 11,000 steps a day, which is far from impossible. We can do 1 million steps this summer. And so I want to put this in people's mind, make a goal to take 1 million steps in Kodiak this summer. It's a beautiful place to walk everywhere. It's good that a lot of us like me are walking about twice as much as I currently am. It also means that those of you, there's a lot of you out there who do that anyway, that you do more than 11,000 steps a day anyway. If you really want to push yourself, you can say it. So 1 million steps is 500 miles. You can say, I'm going to walk 1 million steps in a month, which means you're doing about 16 miles a day. I looked at that and thought that's impossible for me. But for all of us here in Kodiak who have good, even somewhat good knees, I'm encouraging everyone to get out there and start walking every day. Try to get average 11,000 steps a day, and you'll end up with a million steps in June, July, and August.
So you're walking about three and a half to 4 miles every day.
So I figured 11,000 steps was closer to five and a half miles. Because it ends up being, depends on how big your stride is, but it ends up being about 500 miles to do a million steps. So I would walk 500 miles. I'm not going to sing that for you, but that's what I want for people this summer. Walk 500 miles this summer. And hopefully at the end of the summer, we're all a little bit thinner than we were entering it.
It's too bad it doesn't have like a monthly chart. Well, you probably do if you log in your Fitbit to the computer. But so I'm assuming that every day we're going to see a Facebook page from Dr. Jones with a flashing picture of his 11,000.
So I actually have even, I've never done social media, but I've thought about it just for this one time, just saying I'll open a million, the Kodiak's Million Step Summer Facebook page just for that. But I do want people to, if you have an iPhone, you have a pedometer. I've had so many patients. If you get on your iPhone right now, there's an icon you may have never used that has a heart on it. Click on that heart, and whether you like it or not, your iPhone has been tracking your steps for you as long as you've had it, unless you turn that app off, because it comes set on.
This is the Bill Gates thing, right?
Yeah, he's tracking how much exercise you get. So if you have an iPhone, I know for certain you have a pedometer that's been running in the background, whether you knew it or not. And if you have any kind of smartphone, it's easy to get pedometers and to track your steps without having to buy anything extra. And so I encourage everyone, it's, you know, winter's over. A lot of us are a little fluffier than we should be. Let's get out there and exercise. And that's one of the best preventions to COVID. Some vitamin D by being outside and taking the supplement and getting 11,000 steps a day. There's really nothing better we can do to prevent COVID than that.
Shanna, I have one last follow-up for you from the ivermectin person. People taking veterinarian ivermectin from Amazon are telling me the ambulatory care clinic in Kodiak is prescribing ivermectin to patients. So, therefore, using animal ivermectin must be okay, huh? Any truth?
That's interesting. I don't know of any prescriptions that have been prescribed. I haven't prescribed it to anybody. And again, veterinarian prescriptions are different than human prescriptions. I think there was a case of parasites, maybe pinworms or roundworms, or it's also used to treat lice, but I don't think it was used to prescribe. I don't know. I haven't prescribed it for anybody for anything, even including parasites. But there might have been a different reason it was being prescribed if it was prescribed. And again, veterinarian prescriptions are made differently, and the FDA does not regulate the active or inactive ingredients in it. So I would not recommend using veterinarian ivermectin.
Well, it seems like an ethical problem. I mean, is it permissible for a medical doctor to prescribe an animal pill?
No, I don't. It's not at all in our scope of practice.
Yeah. Okay, so those of you out there that are doing it, probably ought to rethink what you're doing. Because this is a person.
Ivermectin is used with humans too. It's just that this is typically something that's used with animals because they have more parasites than humans. But we do use ivermectin in humans, and that's what Dr. Thiebold is saying. Is that there are human preparations and there's veterinarian preparations, and they have different standards.
Gotcha. Shanna, you want to follow up on the 11,000 step thing?
I love it. I think we should have a booth at the Crab Fest, the Million Step Challenge, and we can maybe offer COVID vaccines there as well.
What a great idea.
And I don't want it to replace the Seven Summits Challenge. I want it in addition to the Seven Summits Challenge. One, and we'll just add this one on.
That's how you get your time.
the seven summits count towards your steps.
Yeah. Great idea. Well, lovely discussion again today, folks. Thank you for participating again. Hope it answered a lot of questions for some folks. And we will see you again then next time we do the Dock of the Rock. You have a great day. Thanks. Great week. And we'll get a report next time you're on, Dr. Jones, about how successful you've been on the 11,000 steps in the middle of this rainforest we're living in now.
Sounds great. I'm going to start walking to work, so hopefully I get there.
Great. Bring your umbrella. All right. You guys have a good week. Thank you.
This is KMXT Kodiak 100.1 FM, now joining line one.
Or in person, but I spend a lot of time with people. And one key difference, I think, would be that I want to focus on your goals. What are your goals for you? Because we talk about non-compliance in medicine. And what when a patient is non-compliant, what that means is we have a mismatch of goals. If I think you should do this and you think you should do another thing, I guess we would coin that like the patient's being non-compliant, but okay. Really we have a mismatch of goals. So really a lot of what I do is also goal focused. And, you know, what do you want for your health, or what do you see? And some of that takes coaching to help people see that there's more available to them than maybe their viewpoint had been.
Right. Oh, I like that, a mismatch of goals. And speaking of health coaching,